You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2007 Frankfurt Avenue. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
A lot of what we're talking about today is the concept of prophecy. And prophecy isn't always merely predictive. This is Harry Potter. Sometimes I do the pop culture references. People don't get it. One of the gifts of prophecy is to have a divine urging, a divine inspiration for people to live differently, for the world to be reordered. And one of the gifts that the Holy Spirit gives to the body of Christ is this inspiration, also the equipment to hold on to a conviction even through some storms and to walk the path that we're given to walk. So with a healthy heaping of God's grace on the daily breakfast table, we dare to both prophetically speak truth to power and to attempt to embody through authentic relationships the very people we wish God would send into the world. Here's one spot where Jesus shows how that's done in a pretty cool way in Matthew chapter 9. This is when he's still gathering his core disciples. And this is how Matthew tells his own story. As Jesus went from there, he saw a man named Matthew, same person, sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him. And Matthew got up and followed him. And then while Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said, It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. That's Hosea 6. For I have not come to call the righteous, but the sinners. Jesus offers this clear critique. He also offers a path forward. He's doing this while modeling what he's talking about. I mean, that's true prophetic witness, I think. It's bringing those things together. It doesn't get cheapened by just calling out other people's stuff or just telling other people how they can make a step or have a path forward or even just trying to do it without understanding that there's some systemic stuff that we need to address. The Pharisees in this short moment, I think, kind of represent to a lot of people like the mean ones or the enemies of Jesus. But I think that there really is contemporaries, and especially at this point in his career, according to Matthew, they're showing some thoughtful concern and are bringing up a rather legitimate question or questions. Later on, they try to discredit him and, you know, conspire to murder him and all that stuff. But this wasn't happening at that point. Who were these people, they're wondering, who would want to go and hang out with a rabbi who's teaching this kind of stuff? Why was this teacher presumably instructing and even breaking bread with people who are unclean? The Pharisees were not in league with the Roman military occupiers. You have to just remember this political situation. And there were Jewish people who were in league with the oppressors. They're a problem. You get that? When you have points of, say, foreign governments, or could even be the local government, as we've seen in our situation, but the people who are undermining the justice movement by their corroborating with the powers that be, they're a problem. And tax collectors are those people. And they're being identified as such. And I think that's legitimate. They're main beneficiaries of this dirty relationship with the Romans, benefiting from the literal and figurative expense of their own people. The Pharisees were this reform movement trying to help folks reconnect to God. And through doing this spiritual practice, it required a lot of outward expressions. And a lot of them helped bring a vitality to to the nation. They were very concerned with right living, and not everybody was as far along as them in the journey. Does that sound familiar? People are really good at critiquing others, seeing the gaps between people's values and practices. I think we all have a little bit of that in us, but I hope that when we find ourselves in the story, we're not just going towards our judgiest temptations and thinking, well, I'm just like that person. Among those Pharisees or who they might represent in this moment. But we understand and we relate to as those who have been caught up in the captivity, in the oppression, and in the brokenness of others. We are among those who inherited a political, economic, and ecological system that works towards the clear benefit of certain groups of people at the expense of most others. So we're being welcomed to Christ's table, and Jesus eats with us. Sometimes it's at our house. Sometimes it's at somebody's house that we don't even think that we should be hanging out with. I will get to the fomenting in a second. In Andrea Smith's article, The Problem with Privilege, she suggests that we move from a confessor forgiveness modality in multi-ethnic organizing spaces and in churches where essentially certain groups, particularly the white people, confess their sin and then the people of color forgive them. She says that cycle just perpetuates imagery of oppressor and oppressed. And the oppressed never actually get to become full participants. And the oppressor, likewise, against their own health, continues that movement too. So she suggests movement building while everyone's admission of where they were complicit in allowing white supremacy to continue in small ways, in large ways, in conscious ways, and unconscious ways, and where we're all in that admission, we're open for the Spirit to bind us all together in forgiveness from God, so we form new alternatives that get us out of that didactic cycle of oppression. And they also, and this is an important thing, they help us move beyond individual self-improvement. Individual self-improvement in racial relations is the great enemy of the preferred future that we actually all have. If I had the better attitude, then this would be all better. That's not going to actually bring long-term lasting change to the world. So when we sit at Christ's table, both as someone struggling with our complicity and being forgiven, we can get at the prophetic heart of this good story. And this is another, this is a kind of a vocab word for today, or another one, foment. It's a beautiful sounding word, foment, which might be why it's stuck around for so long. But it generally has a negative connotation to it, which is funny because around Circle of Hope, we start using it in other ways, you know, because any kind of people that hang out with each other long enough, they start to develop their own little lexicon. People start talking about fomenting other good things. Fomenting is generally bad. And it's fomenting is like fomenting civil unrest. It's to instigate or to stir up people's feelings and to get them out there, usually hammering at each other. But back in the day, or you could say during antiquity, it also meant to bathe parts of the body in medicinal ointments. So this word has this beautiful kind of double meaning, so to stir up some stuff and also to bring a healing balm to parts of the body. So keep both in mind as we explore this, one of these core convictions that we have as a Circle of Hope. We have 11 of these. It's based, rather than just having like theological statements that everybody has to agree to, we kind of say these are the things that make us who we are. We're convicted about these things. And then along the way, we collect these proverbs or these wise sayings that help flesh it out. So I'll try to briefly, in this spirit of both bringing up stuff and bringing healing, kind of whip us through this, and then we'll have some time for talk back if you want to bring some questions or bring some more clarity to the group. But this one says that fomenting diversity and reconciliation is at the prophetic heart of our gospel. So the first proverb is that we're always trying to stretch across barriers, across racial, ethnic, class, and cultural divides. It's important when we remember, or it's important that we situate, ourselves appropriately when we're thinking about extending and crossing barriers. Remember that you're a guest at Christ's table. You're not sitting in the place of like where everybody else has to come to, and it's your place of comfort, it's your place of security, and then everybody else has to come and bring and, you know, acclimate to your social norms with how you use personal space, silence, whether it's okay to talk loud, and all these kinds of differences. But when so that it's a space that's Christ's space, not just your family's normal way of having conflict. We're sitting at Christ's table trying to eat a meal with our sisters and brothers. And if we're not intentional, even the church, especially the church in North America, drifts back to the high school cafeteria where we click out, just sit in these tiny little affinity groups, hanging on to those and reinforcing those tiny little groups. We also say that racial reconciliation is a matter of demanding justice, not just peace. This got real interesting, right, with the Charlottesville conflict that we've been talking about nonstop for the last couple weeks. A lot of us have people there that have been working on the ground and organizing and inviting us into that conversation and into those actions. And my friend Erna, who's in seminary with me in my program, wrote a really great piece this week. And she called it, "Why I Stopped Talking About Racial Reconciliation and Started Talking About White Supremacy." Now, if you don't know Erna, probably, so she's Asian, mid-30s, married, mother, she's a worship leader, and she goes into a lot of these spaces, like some of them are pretty big Christian gatherings. I don't remember the names of all of them, and I don't think it would impress you at all if you knew them either. Talk about her as a friend and as a very intelligent person with a lot of insight. Now, in this piece, what she's talking about is this need for justice to be present, not for just racial reconciliation to pad white comfort, or for racial reconciliation language to be the thing that stops conversations or stops people from even being frustrated, or stops people from trying to come up with new paradigms or from new ways of organizing. It's getting to real justice. We say that a gospel that does not reconcile is no gospel at all, which is something that that the very beautiful and intelligent John Perkins made famous, this idea. Last week, I saw a group of people that were no doubt self-identifying as Christians standing across Packer Avenue from me outside the Phillies game, right before the Pride Night game. You could start to conjure in your head all the stereotypes that might come in there, or likelihoods, because you've seen this scenario before. Some of the signs said, you know, homosexuals are going to burn. One of them said, kind of a new one for me, feminists, letter R, sluts. I'm glad you found it a little bit amusing, but it was kind of like word. That was the expression. Now that got even more complicated for me personally, because all the folks were either, you know, black or brown, Latino and stuff, and looked kind of poor. So I in the moment when I was walking with my friends, I didn't want to have to cross a busy street and like take shaming photographs of them or engage them with my great intellectual, like, "Hey, everybody, just so you know, you're getting this wrong again," kind of moment. But it makes me wonder how many attempts to call people out me and my friends do and look just as shameful as those people look to me and my friends. How many times do we speak so loudly that other people have no place to be able to respond? They just get a judgment. And if that's what the good news is this blasting, I'm right and you're dumb kind of thing, that doesn't inspire me as good news. That's the good news that helped settler colonialism have such a rampant expression in this hemisphere. So I feel convicted lately, rather than just call people out, I want to practice calling people in and really having to have these heart-to-heart conversations and relationships that help change communities and structures. We say that we'll do what it takes to be an anti-racist, diverse community that represents the new humanity. The new humanity is a concept that in the letter to the Ephesians, Paul writes about how Jesus is taking divergent groups of people, bringing them in to this newness, to the point where like we're even becoming a new humanity together. It's a cool idea. We say that we'll do what it takes. I think a lot of the times, from my experience, especially in the northeastern United States, or in the United States in general, but in Philadelphia, even trying to build anti-racist diverse community, what it takes is to keep trying and not quitting. What it takes is to not walk away from it. What it takes is to keep listening and keep trying to be humble and keep trying to have an open heart, to keep trying to listen first and forgive. Systemic racism is a mountain in the U.S., or you could say it's a valley. And the mountain of hope, where we keep going back to, that mountain is one of the hills that that we are willing to die on, as that expression goes. We're going to keep trying. There's a lot of Proverbs that goes along with this, because I think we do a lot of talking and thinking about it. But the next one is that, where are we? That all cultures are fallen. They contain some fallenness of their people, yet Jesus reveals God in all of them. The church does not need to force people to leave all aspects of their culture in order to worship God through Jesus Christ. This is a picture of my friend Ray Minicon, who's kind of got the hand up in this cool, like, hey, kind of way. He's a cool leader in the church in Australia. And, you know, he's an indigenous person there and was one of the crucial people to starting this movement over the last 20 years called the World Christian Gathering of Indigenous People. And when those folks get together every other year, they have all these very visceral, beautiful demonstrations of what it's like to be fully followers of Jesus and fully Native. And from all different kinds of parts of the world, some of the critical people who got it going were Maori from New Zealand. And, famously, when the Maori get up and do a haka, this particular dance that you probably have seen on the internet, this different kinds of haka that in different situations that are embodying what it's their discipleship along the way of Jesus. For some people, it's out of their possible realities, because once you become a Christian, you become a white European eventually. That's the sort of where we hope everybody's headed, right? That's the myth of progress. Everybody becomes like that. Everybody dresses a certain way, talks a certain kind of way, acquiesces to basic business practices and Robert's rules of order and all that other horse shit that goes along with, settler colonialism is just one way I'll just keep describing it that a lot of these folks talk about. So rather than that, we're seeing how, and like Martha said it real well too earlier today, how God is big, and rather than arguing about who is fallen or not, or what practices from people groups like the missionaries of yesteryear did, let's see the beauty God has given gifts to in each. And let's all, especially if you are even part of the myth of the melting pot where you lost your culture and traded it in to acquiesce for white skin privilege, doing that work of going back and even wondering about where you came from is a helpful tool to be sorting out through cultures and how Christian they are or not, I think. Sorry that I used a swear word. That was just like a... I guess I try to keep it down, keep it toned down in public spaces, formal spaces. Sometimes just start talking normal. We say that welcoming the stranger is at the heart of being a Christian. Hospitality exposes the fear of the giver and the receiver to the transforming touch of God. Hospitality is more than just being friendly. Hospitality is more than just a behavior, but it describes a generous reception of another person. I'm so glad that Dimitri is with us for a couple weeks. He was a traveling painter for the last couple decades, and he's helping build bridges between Circle of Hope and the Emerald Street Community Farm, where he's doing a collaborative mural. I hope that if you haven't seen it yet, you'll check it out, or at least say hi to him and stuff. But as a person who travels so often, he has so much insight on what it means to extend and receive hospitality. And it's a lot more than just letting somebody come over to your house or entertaining somebody's story for a moment or giving a dollar to somebody playing bongos. But it's about this open-heartedness, this reception, and this connection of souls in some kind of way. And it's transformative when we welcome another, and we are welcomed. We stretch ourselves to worship with diverse styles. God's transnational, transcultural, and even transhistorical. This is what Martha was getting at, that we're not trying to organize our worship to reflect on one's own comforts or favorites. Everybody has their jams. There's certain keys that are easier for some people to sing in. There's all those kinds of musical rules and preferences, but when it comes to our own comforts and favorites, we intentionally are making ourselves uncomfortable. And we're doing it for the sake that we want to know God more. We're doing it for the sake of that we want other people to understand that there is a place for them at God's table. And if that requires us modulating our behavior, even in symbolic ways sometimes, it's healthy for us. It helps us even when she did so well, she connected us to people in a place, not just a language or a rhythm or an instrument. Okay, we're almost there. We are diverse in many ways and will cross boundaries to become more so. Don't bean count us. You're familiar with the term bean counting? It's meant to sound kind of tiny and like something that you wouldn't do. And of course, you're not going to do that. It's the kind of like the armchair sociology that anybody could do in a room like this and kind of start doing their diversity equations. And if you're like me, you do this like everywhere you go. So I'm not trying to say like don't strive for different kinds of people and everything, but I'm just talking about the generalizations. As you look around the room, go ahead, look around the room. Just imagine that like everybody here went to public school in the United States. And just go ahead and tell yourself that. Did anybody here not go to public school in the United States? Throw up a hand real quick. Okay. I had some homeschool. I had a private school one time. You know, whatever category that you're going to try to make about people, it's hard, when you get even this many people together, it's hard to be true. And one of the bad habits that we get into, and this is especially white, this is a bad habit for white people mostly, we invisibilize people that don't fit into our generalizations. Like we want to say everybody here is young. It's only young people. Or all these good-looking people. So no, psych, that's a nice one to say. But like, you know, but you can come up and try to make it seem a certain kind of way for your argument. And really, if you start to have personal relationships, you realize that those things aren't so true. And in racial percentages of groups, a classic space for bean counting, just as evaluative facts, groups hardly measure up to my hopes or expectations. I want it to be better. I think the United States is struggling and is sick, and the church is being separated according to language or nationality or these different things that separate us, sometimes is a major problem. Other times it's a major space for healing. I think for us to understand that God's moving in a lot of different ways is to have some humility and move with how we're feeling moved by God, and not just according to our own limits or our own sense of sociology, because some of you are pretty good at it. But I have to take that God, I have to take that or understand that the movement of God right now doesn't always measure up to my expectations. And sometimes when I could talk about things like racism in the church or diversity in the church, I can unnecessarily, unfairly burden people of color to give me my statistical success so that I feel good about the group. So this is what we're trying to not do. And I have, and I'm being honest about the instinct that I have. And that I don't want to do it. I want to build real relationships and make real alternatives to that kind of stuff. Likewise, true inclusion requires relational work, not just simply institutional recognition. I had several conversations this week about the church's exclusion of women among its leaders for in different traditions. We're into centuries now. You could say millennia. And there's been alternatives to that. But there's a difference that we experienced as a church when we talked about women leading, and we would say, we're totally into it. And when we finally started to have women pastors, which now we have three, it felt different to say that we want women pastors. You know, one of them is aspirational, and it's beautiful, but it's different when you're saying, oh, yeah, and they're here, and we want more. I mean, if that's okay with God, you know, let's make more. And to be across that threshold wasn't just like putting out a shingle on the door that said, hey, we're into women leading, and we really need a women pastor. So if anybody would do that for like a couple $1,000 a year, you'd really help us feel better about ourselves. Woo! But it requires relational work. It requires discipleship. It requires people following as well as leading and working together as teams. So it's one thing to say that we want different kinds of people around here because it's better when there's different kinds of people together. And that's true, but to enter into deep relationship with people that you think might be different than you helps bridge those gaps. And whether it's queer folks or people from different socioeconomic statuses or different languages of origin, mother tongue, if it's about some kind of stylistic difference or age, your willingness and our willingness individually and together to build friendship is multiplied when we build friendship and not just quantify people according to our social categories. And it's hard to do because of these traditions, these alienating practices and principles and laws. So we're doing some catch up. The church's task is neither to destroy, the last two are super philosophical and postmodern, which I appreciate both. The church's task is neither to destroy nor maintain the various labels that divide the world, but to offer a new self in Christ that is deeper than the definitions of the dominators. The dominators offer expressions on people such as illegal. That's a hard one to just get the dominators to eradicate from all of their speech and their laws. Is that really what we need to do? I think slowly we get to do that kind of work, and that's some those of us who are among those people who are the lawmakers, we have to do some of that work. But more important to just come up with correct definitions and correct labels for ourselves or others, we don't need to bend the knee to them. Yet we need to recognize people where they're at. If people are even bringing labels with them, we're going to try to keep helping move ourselves even closer to the one who truly defines us. And that takes both respect of how someone sees themselves, how somebody experiences the world, and it takes humility. Humility to even know that we change. And likewise, bringing people to Jesus is our primary goal. How someone identifies him or herself when we meet them is less important than making room for them in God's kingdom. If someone describes themselves as non-religious or part of a different faith tradition, we're offering space and relationship to belong and to even shape how we do things. How many of you in your cell have a person who does not identify as a Christian? Yeah, you don't need to murmur or raise hands or whatever, but like, or have you if you don't right now? Is that okay with you? And what does that mean? And are you trying to get them to be a Christian right away? Or to even want that? Or are they allowed to belong and figure it out with us? What will last is that deeper connection, not just even just a relationship connection, but when we're rooted in the love of God. To offer a prophetic witness like Jesus did, we need to be able to call out the injustice, especially the systemic injustice. We need to offer a path for people to move forward, to say, here's how you can move from there to a healthier place, not just condemn them. And we also need to model through authentic relationships and community this conviction that we're going for. I loved what Jenna talked about earlier when she said we were going to do these big things that require great faith through the last 6 years and still waiting for the payoff. And that's what starting a business is like, or having children. I mean the payoffs are daily in some ways. In other ways, they're eternal, I hope. You know, this kind of like, you know what I'm saying? But it's like the payoff of like I'm doing this huge risk. When do I like just feel like I did it, you know? I don't know. I think there's moments, but that's not our journey. Isn't just about the satisfaction of our risks paying off. But we're learning that trust with God. And when we have that trust with God, the payoffs become less critical to us. What we get out of it becomes less critical to us. Faithfulness becomes more important. It's rarely going to look like a finished product, especially the church. The church is never going to be like, wow, well, we've arrived, haven't we, everyone? Like that day ain't going to come. And if it does, it's an eternal day. It's being back connected into this huge arc that Jesus is bringing us back into harmony. But I mean, it's not like in 5 years or in 5 weeks we're all just going to really feel like, wow, isn't this finished? But we can still appreciate its problems and its wonders and its strengths. So humility becomes even more important to doing that work and knowing that it's not exactly the fullness of what we feel called to yet. And part of humility is not over-aggrandizing yourself, but it's also seeing the humanity in other people. Just three quick little things away. I think people were doing good prophetic witness in the last couple of weeks. Nuns from the Adorers of the Blood of Christ out in Columbia, PA, they were blocking the progress of a pipeline that the state government had given them according to eminent domain. It said this is critical for the economic health of our region. And they blocked it by creating a chapel. And just kind of saying, sorry, we're adorers of the blood of Christ. You don't put pipelines through this land. It's too dangerous, it's too risky, and it's short-sighted. Similarly, they learned this tactic from the most prolific demonstrators of prophetic prayer as witness was at Standing Rock, where nonviolent water protecting wasn't about just facing down bulldozers. It was standing defiantly in the face of extremely powerful and willing to use violence oppressors. And maintaining not just dignity, but prayer and welcoming people in to come and pray and protect by putting your body on the line. That kind of, and then offering spaces for conversations, and the movement went global. And it's still a powerful image. And if anybody was there or has connections to people who were there, we understand even the power of that kind of witness. A couple nights ago, a few dozen of us gathered here to talk about with Solarize Philly what it could look like, not just for an individual's house to get on solar panels, but what might it be if 50 people from Circle of Hope got their houses on solar? And is that interesting? Why would we do that? And would that be interesting to anyone else? And is that the kind of stuff Jesus does? It moved in waves where Christians even say, like, yeah, okay, the city had a project they wanted to do 500 homes. We'll take 10%. Maybe we can even find another church that'll do another 10%. And if we do 10% and find another church that'll do 10%, betcha we can find another. I'll do one more. If we take 10%, find another church that'll take 10% and another church that'll take 10%, there's not going to be any left. We're going to have exceeded the goal or whatever. That's the good thing about quantifiable goals. But these are opportunities where we're not just dealing with personal stuff and our personal attitudes, but we're modeling, we're demonstrating these convictions that we have in ways that build community, in ways that see clearly injustice and oppression, make space for dialogue and for change.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.